Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In 1978 and 79, Mark Allen Stamity produced MacDoodle Street, a very funny weekly comic strip for the Village Voice about life and art in New York City. It featured, among others, Malcolm Frazzle, a Greenwich Village poet suffering from writer's block who's always facing or racing to meet a deadline for a publication called Dishwasher Monthly. Mr. Stamity is also the creator of the long-running comic strip Washington and the 12-episode 1985 Showtown Network television series that was based on it. And from 2001 to 2004, he drew a monthly comic strip in the New York Times Book Review called Books, B-O-O-X, that made fun of publishing trends. A new 40th anniversary edition of MacDoodle Street has just been published by the New York Review of Books and brings award-winning cartoonist and illustrator Mark Allen Stamity to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
There's a great photograph of you doing an Elvis impersonation for Bill Clinton in the Oval Office. How did that come about?
Well, it was when Elvis first happened, when I was 8 years old, he kind of changed my life. And from when I was a little kid, I was doing an Elvis impersonation. And I actually wrote a kid's book about it called Shake, Rattle, and Turn That Noise Down. Mm-hmm. And then, as an adult, at some point I was at a party with friends, and my friend who was the host had some electric guitars and mics, and I said, "Do you know any Elvis?" And so I started singing it, and they started playing, and then we started doing some shows. We were mostly cartoonists, and we would put on these shows, and one of the guys, Lou Brooks, came up with a name for the thing, Benday and the Zippitones.
Benday.
Which, if you know, yeah.
Benday,
you know,
is an inside word.
Yeah, Benday is Zippitone, and Zippitone, yeah. And Benday, in the days when printing was different, if you wanted to have a halftone, you'd have these little dotted things that you'd put on. So they were both the same thing.
I wrote a song that nobody will understand the joke anymore. Put a 65 screen with an 85 screen. That's a moray.
They create a moray pattern. A moray. Right, right, right. Yeah. I get it. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I did my Elvis a lot, and then when I was doing Washington, the Washington Post used to give a party once a year, a small party upstairs on the 9th floor for a kind of intimate for a group of cartoonists and guests they brought. And also they'd have a few politicians come, like whoever was, you know. So, and one year they had Al Gore. And in those days I knew Al Gore anyway. But after we would eat, there was a tradition of the cartoonists would start telling funny stories and things. And then it became a tradition that at the end of that, I would do my Elvis. And that mm-hmm. would, and Meg Greenfield, my editor, always called it the benediction. So anyway, when Al Gore saw me do it that time. And then lo and behold, 2 years later, in the middle of 1993, in the middle of this huge snowstorm, that was when our dinner was going to be. But it was like this just massive snowstorm. So one of the guests who always came, his girlfriend worked in the White House, and so we were invited to come visit the president. It was like March 1993, and we spent an hour with him, and he was in a sweater and whatever, dealing with Bosnia intermittently, and then at some point Al Gore came in, and then at some point Al Gore said, in his lifetime, Elvis only visited the White House once, but he's here among us today. So that was kind of my cue. So I took off my tie and jacket, rolled up my collar, and
There you are.
That's it. That's how it all happened.
The time Elvis was there was for Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming your parents were the ones who said, turn that noise down.
My mother specifically. God bless her. She's great. She's going to be 100 May 15th,
wow.
actually. But yeah, God bless her. But she couldn't, back then, she couldn't stand Elvis.
But both of your parents were artists.
Yeah.
Your father, Stanley Stamaty, was
Stamaty
was a professional gag cartoonist.
Yeah. And he got my mother into it too. And so she did like they were in the magazines of 40s, 50s, 60s of like Saturday Evening Post, Look, Collier's, all those kind of magazines. The New Yorker was kind of the unattainable, although they would buy gags from my father sometime. And my mother was a gag cartoonist who did teenage cartoons, her specialty, and she had a character, Sitter Sue. And anyway, they were in all the magazines.
How old were you when you realized that you wanted to follow in their footsteps, career?
Okay, so here's the story. My father, when I was in my crib, leaned over my crib and a pencil fell out of his shirt pocket. And the next morning, I'd drawn all over the sheets. So my mother kept that. So they still have they still have that sheet.
Did you begin as a gag cartoonist? Like
I never really got the gag cartoon gene first. I made some kind of awful gag cartoons when I was a teenager for a while, and when I was a kid, a little bit. But really what it was, I grew up looking at, we had tons of books of gag cartoons, so I would read all those, and I'd read comic strips, et cetera. But basically, when I was 14, I found Jules Pfeiffer's 666, and that was like a revelation. And I realized that I wanted to do narratives, and that was such an innovative book. It just opened up to me the possibilities of what cartooning could be.
And one of the commenters on this new edition of McDoodle Street has described it as almost a graphic novel.
I wrote it as a graphic novel, although I call it.
So you knew what you were going to be doing six months down the line?
No, what happened? No, from when I was a teenager, I wanted to write novels, and I wanted to write novels with pictures. So when I started doing the strip and the voice, I always intended it to be a novel as well as I didn't know the term graphic novel. I called it a comic strip novel. And so basically I started somewhere over time I didn't see that far ahead. And when I was about halfway through or so or a little bit, I started to know where I was headed. But basically I wanted to sort of discover my way, which I think, I think that's a good way to approach a story, at least for a good portion of it. I know there's some writers who believe in knowing exactly where you're headed, and I don't know if that's, sometimes that works. I don't know, but I did it a different way.
Didn't McDoodle Street begin as panoramic centerfold cartoons of Greenwich Village and Times Square for the Village Voice?
Well, yeah, what happened?
So you sold them as posters?
Yeah, the Voice. What happened, I'd been doing children's books. I illustrated a book, Yellow Yellow, it's going to be reissued this summer by Drawn and Quarterly.
A lot of reissues now.
I'm getting reissues. And McDoodle,
Which is good for some, because if you look on Amazon at some of the older books, some of them are selling for over $150.
Well, somebody won. The next book I did is the one I wrote and illustrated, Who Needs Donuts? Mm. And that actually, it was out of print for a number of years. And Knopf Random House brought it back for its 30th anniversary. Prior to that, I'd sold one over Amazon for $500.
Wow.
Yeah, people would come to me anyway. So I was doing kids' books.
Thank you.
And at some point, I felt like I wanted an adult audience, and I'd been a fan of The Voice because of Pfeiffer and everything for a long time. And then The Voice was starting to evolve, in a way that I thought maybe I could do something there. So then I approached them with the idea of wanting to do a regular feature, and I told them also, at that point, they had this centerfold that they were doing different things with each week. So I said, I want to do a drawing of Greenwich Village in the style of Who Needs Donuts for your centerfold. So I did that, and then I did another one of Times Square. And at that, right around that time, they after the first one, they gave me a little strip in the paper that started out in the front, but then ended up in the classifieds. But then two cartoonists left, and there were two openings there. And so they said, you know, if you got something, let us know. And I took about 2 weeks, pulled it together, and there was McDougal Street.
And you were living on McDougal Street?
I was living on McDougal between 3rd and Bleecker. I lived there from 1968 to 1990, a fourth-floor walk-up railroad flat, and eventually I got the one next door, too, with a door between them. And it was a great place to be for many years. Yeah.
You said Tom Robbins, a novel by Tom Robbins, was one of your inspirations at the start.
Yeah, another roadside attraction. When Yellow Yellow first came out, I got a letter from a young woman named Joan Vigliotta in Florida who worked in a bookstore, and she wrote me this letter about she just loved Yellow Yellow and on and on. So anyway, then every year on my birthday, she would send me a birthday present. And one year she sent me Tom Robbins, Another Roadside Attraction. And I read that novel at the time. I loved that novel. And I just felt like, you know, this is the genre that just some insane, you know, insane comic novel. This is the genre that I've been aiming toward.
So 1 week strip would be about an ongoing battle between irate businessmen and bearded beatniks for control of the cafe that you
it was based on the Figaro. I used to work in
Cafe Fizz.
I used to write my strips in cafes, so you know,
the sign in the Cafe Fizz in one of your strips is gentlemen are required to wear a beard or long mustache. Neckties are prohibited.
Right. And you could rent beards when you came in.
Now, also the you might have one about a plot involving a genetically engineered dishwashing monkey. You also had one about visions of a soothsayer on the bus. Were these inspired by things that you? Well, obviously, no dishwasher monkey, but dishwashing is a theme throughout these.
Well, it came together, I guess, from a lot of different directions. It was all part of this. Ultimately, it was part of the same storyline. But early on, when I first came to the city, I used to take long walks at night. I'd sometimes start about, say, 11 o'clock at night, and I'd walk till maybe 3 a.m. or so, And if I was on 105th Street and I wanted to, you know, come back home, I just walk home, you know, in the middle of the night. And we had a teacher at Cooper Union named Ben Cunningham. He was an op artist. He called himself a visual voluptuary. And in those days, I was something of a lost soul, but I knew I wanted to do something in this work.
You didn't want to paint.
I wanted to make art. I can't say that I had exactly defined what I wanted to do, but the thing was, I basically these walks at night were kind of intuitively guided. The notion of visual voluptuary was kind of a helpful notion, but I would basically feel as if I was kind of mystically guided to just soak in, you know, imagery, to soak in the city, soak in characters. Excuse me. And my I would say, you know, my book Who Needs I always had a sketchbook with me. My book Who Needs Donuts, the store, basically one night I was in a Bickford's coffee shop, my third year in Cooper Union. There was an old woman lying across the counter, as kind of seemed like she was asleep. A guy came in, he said he wants two cups of coffee to go. And the waitress said, would you like donuts with your coffee? He said, no, thank you. And the old lady lifted up her head, pointed at the ceiling and said, that's right. Who needs donuts when you've got love? So I wrote that in my sketchbook, and eventually I made a book out of it. There was a night I met a guy named Eddie. He was on St. Mark's Place, and he had this old mattress, and he was trying to sleep on this old mattress that he was over by where the Electric Circus used to be, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know. And I started talking to the guy, and I basically kind of heard his life story, and it was a really interesting story. I used to, you know, have these. I used to talk to a lot of these kind of people and take in things. So it was,
And then use them.
Yeah, use them, or they would also would set off my imagination. So every it's kind of a, you get into a zone about it, and if the and I was looking for a kind of a craziness, a kind of a, I was fascinated by the city. I was fascinated by, you know, potentially comic elements and poignant elements. So the basically Eddie in Who Needs Donuts is the ultimate guru, and he basically appears to be what we used to call a Bowery bum. He's lying on his back in the, you know, basically near the Bowery, and Helga Parsnip, who is a bag lady that Malcolm has met on the bus, who tells his fortune by putting her hand on his ear and looking into an empty whiskey bottle and sees his future. She had made a connection early on with Eddie, Eddie Reddy, her basically her guru, and he had been a dishwasher for many years, and eventually he'd had a vision of Rebecca the cow, who is the deity of McDoodle Street, and he came to understand the deep wisdom of dishwashing, and then Malcolm Frazzle, you know, was writing these poems about dishwashing. And it turned out that Destiny had a mission for him. And to me, it was this kind of intuitive thing about dishwashing, the notion of it as a meditative kind of a process that could bring inner wisdom.
My guess is Mark Allen Staverty, whose cartoons, illustrations, covers, and comics have appeared in Time magazine, The New Yorker, Harper's, The New Republic, New York, GQ, and many other magazines and newspapers. And the 40th anniversary edition of his McDoodle Street cartoons has just been published by New York Review of Books with some additional material. We'll get into that in a little bit. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. How autobiographical is the character of Malcolm Frazzle? He's always facing a deadline. Did you always feel the pressure?
Kind of,
because you had to turn out a cartoon every
week?
I
have to say that was quite autobiographical. And in McDoodle Street, there's a lot that's autobiographical. Just before I began working on McDoodle Street, I had a beard are they horn rim glasses? Is that what they call them? You know, the black plastic things like the old Woody Allen glasses. Mm-hmm. So I had those, you know, that's what I looked like for 9 years. And just before I started doing McDoodle Street, I shaved my beard and I got these wire rim glasses. So I was drawing, Malcolm looked like what I had just previously looked like. And sometimes I would appear in the comic strip as me with, you know, looking like, you know, my beardless self. And, yeah, I would say Malcolm, you know, had a crush on Brenda Fund, a cheerleader. I have to say that I had a similar experience. I've kept diaries all my adult life. Malcolm did keep a diary. I did write a poem about that cheerleader. Malcolm wrote a poem about the cheerleader. There are many things. My father was not an appliance repairman.
I'm assuming that some of the other characters with these great names, Fred Mello, Miss Bitely, Doris Drainpipe, Gussif Ranto, were all based on real people as well.
Well, I have to admit, you know, Gussif Ranto was kind of me in a way, too. You know, I hoped to be a great art genius, and you know, there were some disappointments. I didn't drink as much cappuccino as he drinks, and I didn't have the breakdowns that he had. But
you opened the book with 7 comic strips about Herbert Hippo.
Yeah, well, that was the little strip I had in the beginning, and Herbert was going to be active. Excuse me, in the border of the comic strip in an ongoing basis, but it happened that right around that time, Playboy magazine started having this comics section, and a bunch of us cartoonists were called to action there, and Playboy wanted to run Herbert Hippo, so then they wanted to not have it be in The Voice, so but Herbert appears
next to Little Annie Fanny.
Actually, there was another section that had that it was sort of a separate section. I think maybe Annie Fanny was in the same thing, but I think it was a separate section. I know Art Spiegelman had one, and Bobby London had one, and you know Dirty Duck was in there, and Herbert Hippo was in there, and so Herbert Hippo ran for they reprinted a few of those. And then they told me they wanted to own the character of Herbert, and I said no. So then that was the end of that.
You mentioned that you stuck a lot of stuff into each strip. There's lots of details. And each has a title and a subtitle, examples of some of the subtitles. The comic strip that knows how to use a fork.
Yeah, No. The comic strip that knows how to identify a salad fork.
Oh, okay.
Critical.
Comic strip that graduated from Long Branch High School.
Yep.
The ticklish comic strip. The comic strip that never met Leonid Brezhnev. So on top of all the characters, should I assume that the comic strip itself was a character?
Yeah, the comic strip became a character in the comic strip, and actually at a certain point went out and got drunk in the comic strip the comic strip went through a few of its own struggles.
A lot of the things still are relevant today, but some of the jokes may be lost on younger people. For example, we talked about how you couldn't wear a necktie at Cafe Fizz. The necktie becomes a symbol for the CLF, the Conservative Liberation Front.
Yeah, there was, well, back when, I guess a lot of younger people don't know, there was a National Liberation Front in North Vietnam, and there was the Palestinian Liberation Front. And so basically, you know, at that time, Jimmy Carter was the president, and I don't think... I don't think anybody really expected there'd be a big, kind of conservative move into the White House with Ronald Reagan. At the time I started, there was no hostage crisis. Jimmy Carter was doing pretty well in the polls, I think, at the time I began it. But anyway,
that's before OPEC.
No, it was after OPEC. The OPEC, I think, was early 70s. But it was, basically, the Iranian hostage crisis is kind of, you know, and then Ted Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter, calling him a Republican, and that really, so it was the Conservative Liberation Front, and they refused to remove their neckties when they barged into the Cafe Fizz, and they refused to rent a beard.
And they are Wayne Newton fans. Anyone under 30 even knows who Wayne Newton is?
Yeah, see, that's funny because I when I was a kid, Wayne Newton was a child star, and he used to go on Ed Sullivan, and he used to sing the corniest songs, I thought, and I was into R&B, I was into soul music and Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and all this, and Wayne Newton just seemed like a corny guy to me. And so anyway, so these and I didn't know, by the way, that in the as it turned out, in the 1980 Republican convention that nominated Ronald Reagan, Wayne Newton performed. And I didn't know, I had no idea of his politics, but basically the Conservative Liberation Front, one of their demands was that the Cafe Fizz play 5 hours a day of Wayne Newton songs. And Malcolm Frazzle did not like Wayne Newton, and he kind of made an indiscreet remark that got him in difficulty with the CLF.
So you started to get into political issues even then.
Although I was really, you know, that I did, but I hadn't gone full blast. It was kind of, you know, an element. It was only eventually that I was invited to do politics for the Washington Post, and then you know, eventually got deeper into it. At that time, I definitely had political feelings, but it, you know, McDougal Street is arguably not a heavily political strip.
I was wondering while I was thinking about our conversation, just how we were going to get around the fact that your cartoons are just so visual and so packed with all sorts of interesting drawings and ideas. I'm encouraging all of our listeners, if you don't have the book, go to the internet and look up Mark Allen Staverty and look up McDoodle Street or some of the later ones.
Or they could even go to a bookstore and buy lots of copies.
Yes. Well, actually, you're going to be at McNally's.
Jackson Bookstore in a conversation with Leanna Fink on April 10th. I think that's a it might be a Wednesday. I'm not sure.
A book party.
But it's a book party. Yeah, a book party. It's a she's going to talk with me about McDoodle Street.
Well, there are many layers to each strip, and that's what I was alluding to. For instance, sometimes there are characters outside of the story who live in the border of the comic strip and speak. In a flashback, Malcolm's guidance counselor advised him against committing suicide and says, "There's no future in it, Malcolm." And that's when Malcolm discovers poetry.
He wrote about he wrote about a cheerleader he was in love with named Brenda Fun, and it was unrequited love initially. Now I don't want to make any spoilers, but he did encounter Brenda eventually again, with more positive experience. But now I'm trying to remember where I was with the. You said
he's dissuaded from committing suicide.
I was going to talk about the borders. Yeah, I went to Cooper Union, and at the time I went to Cooper Union. There was not a lot of focus on commercial art in any way. It was very much kind of a fine art school. And so I spent a lot of time in, and I think that was a good thing for me. So the streets of New York were a big influence. And also,
Cooper Union is so well located for the kind of thing you were doing.
Oh, it's fun. It's wonderful.
Astor Place.
Right. Astor Place, right in the middle of everything. So it was a wonderful place to be. Because there was such a fine art kind of a push, I spent a lot of time in museums, Metropolitan Museum, a lot of places, and I looked at many other kinds of art. And when I did McDoodle Street, I wanted to experiment with the form of a comic strip, and I also wanted to bring other elements to it that maybe hadn't been there before. So I had these kind of friezes around the strip, different things that were inspired by, you know, all kinds of art that I'd see in the museums, that I'd see in books, I wanted to kind of come at a comic strip from the outside of comic strips and just, you know, make it something that it hadn't been. So I tried to bring other elements then.
And occasionally you put special offers into the strip. For example, there's a free gift for cutout face and forehead wrinkles.
Yeah,
where did that come from?
Well, it was from my from my mind. But basically, you know, there were young people that didn't seem to have a lot of gravitas. I offered these wrinkles that they could glue on their face and their forehead and cheeks, so they would have more gravitas and be taken more seriously. And there's also an opportunity to shake hands with Malcolm Frazzle if you have an X-Acto knife. And I don't think that ever happened in the history of comic strips. I don't think anybody ever shook hands with Ali Oop or Little Abner. So Malcolm offered a more personal experience.
And I suspect you were thinking, hey, what can I do that nobody else has done?
I wanted to just, you know, it seemed like a comic strip could be a lot more, that in some way there's no limit to what it could be. I was trying to explore those things, and the notion that it's an organism, so then I felt like the possibilities were infinite, and I tried to, you know, find as many of them as I could in the given year and a half that I did it.
And have fun.
Yeah, exactly.
How old were you at the time?
Let's see. So I'd have to subtract. I was 78. So I was born in 1947. So I was 31, 32 in the years I was doing it.
And also, I'm sure you were getting a lot of positive feedback.
I got wonderful feedback. It was really fun because when I was doing children's books, there was kind of a limit to what I could put in a kid's book, even though I And so when I so in McDoodle Street, I could get a lot more in it, and I could get a real appreciation it was a wonderful the appreciation I got.
At one point, you apologized to your readers for losing control of the strip. I'm quoting.
Yeah, the characters got
out. I'm beginning to lose control of my characters. I did not want the quiche to be destroyed. I had hoped that the comic strip would be thoroughly nonviolent.
Pretty terrifying, huh? Yeah, imagine yourself sitting there with that pen and it's out of control.
We're back with Mark Allen Savaday, whose McDoodle Street has just been issued in a new version or a new edition by the New York Review of Books.
And this time it's in hardcover.
Now, what led to that? Was it just somebody realized that it was 40 years in time to do a 40-year edition?
It didn't exactly happen that way. It was I got an email from New York Review Comics from a man named Lucas Adams, and he a man Gabriel, and Gabriel. They started New York Review Comics at New York Review of Books, and they inquired about two strips that I'd done. This there was a very experimental strip that I did after McDoodle Street, and also there was McDoodle Street, and they wanted to see both of them. They had started a thing of reprinting old comic books or old comic graphic novels, etc. So they were interested, and they'd been I think the first person that told them about it, oh, you have to pardon me, his name's not coming to mind, but anyway, they were told about it by several people. And so we met, and I dropped off all this stuff, and so they decided they wanted to reprint McDoodle Street. So that's essentially how it happened.
You write about your readers in one of the strips, quote, "He's young and on the move, doing things, meeting people, chewing gum, starting fights with bus drivers. The kind of person you can be if you read the aforementioned comic strip."
Yeah, that was, well, that,
playing
I think that
with
was
your
probably
readers.
Typical reader, I guess.
And did you meet many of your readers?
I met a lot of them. Yeah, they weren't all arguing with bus drivers. Actually, I don't know if I might have made that up.
Malcolm writes for Dishwasher Monthly. Where did that come from? Why?
It
dishwashing?
Came basically. You know, I
it's
sat down.
It's reference throughout the strip.
It came from. Yeah, it came from. It came from the excitement of the notion that I could have a comic strip in the Village Voice, and I basically sat down to work on it, and the next thing I knew, I was putting my characters in a cafe, and basically it just naturally started developing, and there was Malcolm. He looked a lot like I used to look like, and he was struggling to write a poem, basically, as I wrote it, things occurred to me, and then as I moved along, well, I've got a guy who's writing poetry about dishwashing for Dishwasher Monthly. So where's this headed? You know, so I basically found my way, step by panel by panel, step by step.
McDoodle Street started to wind down in 1977, and a final strip announces a leave of absence.
Yeah.
You expected to come back?
I expected to come back, but I had realized over time, and I'll say this, Lucas and Gabe said to me, it never did come back. So Lucas and Gabe said to me, would you mind writing an addendum of some sort that would tell what happened? You know, how come McDoodle Street never came back? And that happened to have been a very significant period of my life, my creative process, etc. And so at the end of the book, I wrote and drew a 20-page comic strip addendum that tells that story. And essentially, as I worked on the strip over a year and a half, it gradually kind of took over my life. There was I wanted it to be good, so then it's like if people would say, oh, this week's strip was funny, I'd say, well, how did I do that? What did I, and how am I gonna be funny again. And over, and so the, you know, essentially there was a whole, I realized that over time it was not really a sustainable thing that I to approach in the way I was approaching it.
Well, you write, McDoodle Street is the closest I ever got to the direction I wanted to go with my work.
The kind of, well, I wanted to make these crazy graphic novels, basically, which is right now I'm working on a couple of graphic novels. But basically, I want, doing them week to week to a newspaper deadline, is, what I found isn't the best way to do. To do, you know, like, for instance, you get to a certain point halfway through a story and you might realize, well, gee, if I could go back, you know, to you know, and fix this, then it's
you
better.
Could, if you're writing a manuscript, but yeah, you can't do it if you've
already
published.
You can't do it that way if you've already published. Now, there's a good thing about it because you've committed, you know, and you gotta go from where you are. And that's, in some ways, that's a great thing, but not for me, not, you know, not for to do a lot of books, you know. It was like, it was great that I could do that strip that way that time, but it did kind of take over my life because I didn't want to mess up. So I would kind of like set aside my life to make sure I didn't mess up.
And you say that you had a revelation about the work that you wanted to do in the months after you stopped doing McDoodle Street. Didn't have to do with the not only the end of the strip, but losing your father.
My father died the day it was very. It seemed like it was almost synchronized. My father. After I finished McDoodle Street, there were 2 weeks in which I did the cover and all the extra parts for the book, and then I'd had the book contract for quite a while. Exactly in the hour that I was delivering the all the materials for the book, September 12th, 1979, between 3 and 4 p.m. That's when my father died, exactly then. And it felt like he'd waited. I mean, we weren't talking that day. But it felt like somehow we were connected, and he waited till I was ready to deal with it. And then I went through a period where I tried to write McDoodle Street again, but I just wasn't in that place. And it was about 6 months that I just was kind of lost.
But what about the characters? When something like that comes to an end, do the characters and the voices just disappear?
I once
wrote a novel, and even when I stopped, working on any day, I was going to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. Voices would suddenly come to me, and I'd have to stop in the middle of the street and write things down.
Well, I'd say that Malcolm Frazzle and Helga Parsnip and Hugo, the deli man, and all those characters are very alive to me, and they're very real to me. But it was time to go to another place, and I really had to let go. I can tell about what happened to me, how I went to the next place.
Well, you had a number of different things happen.
Yeah. A few things.
There was a column. There was Time Magazine.
Later I did. Well, that was much later, Time Magazine. Basically, what happened at that point after McDoodle Street was I ended up after about 6 months doing some work just for myself, where I would just kind of go into a zone and do these comic strips that I did them just to enjoy doing them. I didn't know where I was headed with them. I used to walk around with them in my chocolate soup bag, if you remember what that was. And there was a woman that I was dating at the time, and I didn't want anybody to see them because I'd become very self-conscious about what will people think at that point. I didn't, you know, is it funny? Isn't it funny? And eventually I showed it to this woman I was dating, and she liked them, which astonished me. And then I ran into a voice copy editor, showed her, and she liked them. And she said, you should take this back to David at The Voice. And I went to David at The Voice, the editor, and he said, great, when do you want to come back? And so I did this experimental strip for a year that was very different from anything I'd ever done, both visually and verbally. And then that was
just change your drawing style?
I certainly expanded my drawing style. I just really wanted to break out of everything I had been doing and work much differently. And it was a year into that McDoodle Street was published the first time. And it turned out Meg Greenfield, editorial page editor of the Washington Post, had been following all my strips and the voice. And McDoodle Street got this great review in the Washington Post. It had the Conservative Liberation Front there. Mm-hmm. And then she called me up and wanted me to do a McDoodle Street version of Washington, which I then ended up doing for many years.
Starting in 1981. It was in the Village Voice and the Washington Post.
It was in the Voice, the Washington Post.
It wound up in 40.
It was syndicated in 40 newspapers. At first, it was syndicated sort of because papers would call me. And then the Washington Post picked it up and they syndicated it.
And it was called Washington.
Washington, yeah, with Congressman Bob Forehead.
Now that was it, that saved you to some degree because in the added material to the new publication,
McDoodle Street, you tell Jules
Pfeiffer that you feel like you're destroying your career.
Right. Well, Jules, we were at the Voice Christmas party when I was doing those very experimental strips. I mean, I did strips about my father's death. I did strips that were very silly, very stream of consciousness, all kinds of. I mean, it was different every week. It was often very different panel to panel. And Jules at the Christmas party, Voice Christmas party, he said, "I really admire what you're doing. It's very brave." And this meant a lot to me because he was my hero, and now he is my colleague, of course. And I said I thanked him, and then I said I feel like I'm destroying my career. And Jules said to me, "That's how you should feel every time you sit down to your drawing board," which I knew exactly what he meant.
Now, so Washington commented on politics of the day.
Yeah.
Do you regret the fact that you're not doing it now because there's so much rich material?
Well, you know, yes and no. I don't. I'd say there's rich material, and maybe if I got the right offer, it would be intriguing. But it's also creatively, it wasn't everything I wanted to do. You know, there's a certain world you're in politics. You take in a lot of painful information. In some ways that canvas is more limited than the kind of thing I really wanted to do.
Well, right now we rely on the late night talk shows.
Yeah, we're doing this brilliant
for the comedy
brilliant
in Washington.
Work done.
But it seems to me that a cartoon could cover all sorts of things that they can't cover.
Well, somebody made a bit of an offer recently. I got a couple of feelers about it, and I'm thinking about doing Washington again.
You don't have to do it every week.
No, I could do it exactly. I know I would want to still approach it in a little different way than how I have approached it. But I certainly have, like I said, I've kept diaries for since I was in high school, and I write a lot of rage in my diaries about our political situation these days.
Now, are you one of those people who notices how much influence you've had on others? Because your work at that point was kind of like a breakthrough. It was unlike anything else. Well, it was unlike anything else.
I appreciate
that.
Maybe
Art Spiegelman to some degree, but
well, I'd say that I see work that I think is definitely influenced by my work, but it's we all have influences, so that's one of those things where people outside of me have to basically tell me what they think or tell the world what they think.
One of your books for children is Aaliyah's Mission, Saving the Books of Iraq. And that's based on a true story?
Yeah, it was a true story. I can't remember the writer in the New York Times wrote the article. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. But there was one other children's book done on the same subject. But basically, my editors at Knopf Random House basically said to me they found this article, and since I was a children's book author illustrator and also had done political cartoons for so many years, they thought I'd be the perfect person to make it into a graphic novel for children. And it was a really Aaliyah's Mission. It was the story of this librarian in Basra, Iraq, who when the Iraq war was about to happen, she started shipping all the books out of, she got a bunch of people helping her, like from the restaurant next door, et cetera. They started moving all the books out of the library into their private homes, and it would, and they saved like 300,000 books, I think, before the library eventually got bombed and burned down in the war, which she just was very concerned would happen. So that was a really beautiful, powerful story. And the real hero of that, the writer's name was something like Iwa Diwan or something. The writer who did that reporting was the real hero of getting that story.
And do we know what happened to those books?
They were saved. And then, and I believe she got funding to rebuild the library. Her name was, I think her name was Aaliyah Baker or Aaliyah Muhammad Baker. I don't remember exactly offhand now her name. But they did apparently rebuild the library.
Wasn't there some resistance to that book in Florida?
I've heard that. I can't say that it affected my life that much. But
why would they object?
Well, you know, it's just there's just bigotry because it's just, you know, people have ideas about Muslims that are that I think are boiled down to bigotry. I mean, because I think it was about a Muslim librarian being presented in a positive way that somehow they didn't want children to see that, and that's what little I know about that.
Your cartoons have been used in different ways as posters, as regular comic strips, as books for children, five of them, etc. Do you adjust your drawing style for each kind of project?
I have adjusted my drawing style for, I did a book, Where's My Hippopotamus, that's very different from my book, Mini Maloney and Macaroni, that's very different from my book, Small in the Saddle. Small in the Saddle is somewhat similar to Who Needs Donuts, although not as intense. And that first book I illustrated that's coming out this summer with Drawn in Quarterly, Yellow Yellow, written by Frank Ash, that was the kind of a prelude to my style in Who Needs Donuts, and that's the prelude to the style in the posters I did for The Voice of Greenwich Village and Times Square, all of which was, you know, was the style for McDoodle Street. So it but there's, you know, I did the book Shake, Rattle and Turn That Noise Down. that one is a if you look at all those books next to each other, you definitely see, I think you'll see something that runs through, but you'll also see that a lot of them are very different in the approach.
In your dedication to this book, you include a note to every single one of the nice people I've met in the offices of the Village Voice.
Yeah. Now, that experience of being at the Village Voice, where I was there 16 and a half years, in really wonderful years there, I met so many great people. It was a home, and we had a very happy world there. And writing and drawing McDoodle Street and having all the support and the appreciation, it was wonderful. And there were, you know, there's so many creative people there, so many, and it was, and there were, you know, funny incidents, and there was the time when Rupert Murdoch owned it at one time. Like, I was about 10 strips into McDoodle Street, and suddenly Rupert Murdoch's, the man working for him at fired Marianne Partridge, who was our editor at that time, before her contract had run out. And I remember, so we were threatening a big shutdown, and we were, so all of us voice people, we were there on, you know, it was on University and 11th at that time. We were up on the second floor, and this guy, Joel Siegel, was there from Channel 11, and he's interviewing Jack Newfield. And I remember Jack Newfield said, if Rupert Murdoch does not honor the rest of Marianne Partridge's contract, if Bill Ryan does not honor the rest of Rupert Murdoch, if Bill Ryan, wait, does not honor the rest
Bill
of
Ryan
Marianne,
was Murdoch's, yeah, man.
He was Murdoch's, he was a man running, you know, Uber guy at The Voice. If Bill Ryan does not honor the rest of Marianne Partridge's contract, Rupert Murdoch will own a parking lot.
Well, actually, right now, that's kind of the case.
Yeah.
But did you feel?
There's not even a parking lot now.
Did people at The Voice feel pressure to adjust because The Voice had a reputation for being a rather liberal publication, and then suddenly Rupert Murdoch, the man who gave us the who changed the Post from being the very liberal Post to what it is now, and to give us Fox News,
Did we feel pressure at the voice? No, he was hands off, but he tried to be hands on some of the time. This is the story I heard at the time. This is what I heard at the time was, and it may be wrong. I mean, in terms of the numbers, but I heard that the New York Post in those days was losing $10 million a year. I think The Voice was earning him $1 million a year, so The Voice was helping to contribute to the Post to keep it alive. And what I understood then was Rupert Murdoch knew that The Voice was a certain kind of species, and if he tried to turn it into one of his kind of a tabloid trashy papers, it would kill it, and he bought it by accident when he bought New York Magazine is really what he was after, and The Voice came along with it at that time. He bought it out from under Clay Felker. But I do remember this is a story as I remember it. I can't guarantee it, but I believe it, and this is what I was told. Somewhere, I think it was in the 80s, Rupert Murdoch called up David Schneiderman and insisted that he fire Jack Newfield, who was, writing about, Rupert Murdoch was upset about a lot of things, and David stood up to him. So, I mean, I think David did stand up to Murdoch, and Murdoch understood the creature that he had. So I think generally, Murdoch was held at bay or just was sort of hands off. And eventually he sold it. And I think, and the numbers I heard, I think the numbers as I heard them, I won't try to, he sold it for a lot more than he bought it is what I recall.
Well, in the end, it was pretty much being kept alive through classifieds, and some of them rather shady.
I think, that got
and
really
there's
bad.
There's been a scandal connected to that.
That was a terrible thing. You know what happened was in the 80s, there was a guy, John Evans, at The Voice, who before there was an internet and all that. There was a guy, John Evans, who was. I think he started out in the ad section, and he was a genius, as I understand it, of marketing classified ads. They weren't those obscene things. They were just like, he did a lot of really innovative things with classified ads, and eventually Rupert made him the publisher of The Voice, and eventually he took him off into his magazine world, and suddenly, this man who had been kind of a hippie was in three-piece pinstripe suits, and he was so Murdoch took some talent, from The Voice, but in the later years, and after I left The Voice, that there was that whole thing with all these obscene ads and all that
prostitution
that time it was owned by these whole other people who were not even in New York, and that was years after I was there, so I can't speak to it too much.
I feel that I should list some of the honors and awards that you've received, just so that our audience...
I object!
audience knows just who I've been talking to. They include 2 gold medals and 2 silver medals from the Society of Illustrators, the Premio Satira Politica Forte de Marmi, 2005, from the Museum of Satire and Caricature in...
Forte de Marmi, Italy.
A Page One Award from the Newspaper Guild of New York, the Augustus St. Gaudens Alumni Career Award from Cooper Union.
Yes.
So you must feel good about all
that. It gives me a warm feeling to be appreciated. Yes, definitely.
And right now you're working on a number of other projects?
Yeah, I'm working on 2 graphic novels. One is kind of a Western thing. It's because I grew up watching Westerns, and that kind of framework is in my mind, or that genre. So although it's a Western, I've got about 65 pages, 6 chapters, and it's it's not your usual Western. It goes off where it wants to go. You know, it goes where it wants to go.
In other words, it's going to be funny as well.
I think so. I think so. And it's kind of goes places where Westerns don't usually go, I'd say, or in some ways. And then the other one is, you know, like I said, I've kept diaries all my adult life. And the other one is, I've got about 30 pages, two chapters. And that one is, kind of a personal thing. It's a novel. It's a graphic novel. I have different names and for everything and everybody, but it's basically, it kind of goes through my life in a more kind of serious way, or certain events of my life, beginning with the kind of a trauma as a teenager and then how I kind of found my way.
Did you feel any nostalgia when you were working on the McDoodle reissue?
Oh, I loved it. I loved going back to those characters.
You recognize the guy who did that?
The guy? Yeah, well, that guy's eyes were different than mine. I mean, he could. I drew all the McDoodle stuff to size, I don't draw that tiny these days. But I would say it was a pleasure going back to, you know, it's the addendum starts off with the comic strip Lost and Drunk, and it's a has been and almost gets into a barroom fight until Malcolm and Helga save it. And I love those characters, and I love McDoodle Street. You know, it was, like I said, for many years, I would say, and it, you know, it was the closest I ever got to the kind of crazy novel I wanted to write.
And the 40th anniversary edition of McDoodle Street has just been published by the New York Review of Books. If you would like to meet Mark Allen Samity and celebrate the book, on the 10th, that's just a few days
April,
from now.
April 10th.
McNally Jackson.
Today's the 3rd. Yeah, so it's next Wednesday at McNally Jackson. I think it's 7 p.m. And the brilliant original cartoonist, Leanna Fink, is going to, I guess, interview me, have a conversation with me about McDoodle Street.
Mark, thank you so much for being on our
show. Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Kate Gwan Allison, who produced today's segment. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.